Keep Talking exists to have conversations that might help to make a better society and a better culture. I believe that each guest has important information and stories to make public. This is the Keep Talking podcast. To support it, please take a second and subscribe to the show. It helps to make this content possible. This book reads like you probably have had your own experiences and challenges with the concept of time and time management. And I thought it might be interesting for people listening to this to learn about who the young Oliver was in terms of how much he tried to pack into his productivity, his life. What's the trajectory that led you to even think about these concepts in the book and write the book in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think it's probably true for anyone writing things, and I'm sure it's not just writing that you're drawn to the things that you struggle with, right? They're the ones that hold interest. If something just comes really naturally to you from birth, it's not necessarily going to be that interesting. So, I think I wouldn't have put it this way for a large proportion of my life, probably, but I think I've always been sort of in some way fixated on time and on the question of trying to use time well. I think there's probably a big piece of it that is sort of to do with self-worth or self-esteem, this notion that you've got to sort of do a certain amount or up to a certain level in order to be able to feel good about yourself. There is a category in psychology, a category of person labeled the insecure overachiever, which if it's, I think it isn't really bragging to suggest that I feel that way because it has the overachieving part, but it also has the insecure part. And I think that's a very common thing these days. And I think that I always feel like that resonates whenever I see that description, right? Somebody who does an awful lot, who is driven, who's ambitious, who achieves plenty of things, but fundamentally on some level maybe does so from a sense of lack, from a sense of needing to measure up to some standard, not just because they're kind of exuberantly expressing the joy of being alive, but because they kind of need to be in control of their time and need to be able to meet every demand that is made and need to avoid disappointing people and letting them down and all the rest of it. So that's the sort of distant background. You know, when I was at college, I was a huge bundle of anxiety, getting my undergraduate degree. And then, of course, I did really well in my undergraduate degree. So it reinforced the belief somewhere deep in my unconscious that stressing a lot about time and being extremely anxious about it led to good results. And then I think in many ways I've used journalism and book writing all the way through my career as an adult to sort of grapple with these things and do a bit of therapy in public. So, you know, I hope that wasn't a more personal answer than you were wanting. I can give you the sort of career milestones version, but I think that's the sort of deeply true version probably.
Yeah. I identify with a lot of what you just said too. There's a quote I've heard you recite that I wanted to read out loud and get your comments on it related to these ideas. And I think this comes from a Zen Buddhist monk. The quote is, quote, "What makes it unbearable is your mistaken belief that it can be cured." And I wanted to give you an opportunity to speak to that as it relates to what you just talked about and about the concept of time and the pressure to perform and be productive.
Yeah, this comes from Jocko Beck. She was a Zen teacher, American Zen teacher. And that basic idea that it's very central to Zen, and it crops up in other ways, but that basic idea that like we treat life as some kind of problem to be solved, or to use her analogy, a disease to be cured, and our problems arise not from having the problem or having the disease, but from the belief that there must be a way out of it. And I think at the sort of broadest level, we can talk in more detail, but I think the broadest level, that for me, that really just conveys this notion that we are, all of us, limited in all sorts of basic built-in ways in terms of the amount of time we have, the amount of control we have over our time, the amount of knowledge or certainty we can have about the future, all of this. And most of our troubles with time, I think, stem from trying to find ways to feel like that's not the case, or that we might be on the way to finally transcending our limitations once and for all. Whereas I think a lot of Zen stuff, and hopefully in some way my writing, tries to sort of call us back to the idea that the problem there, the suffering, the torment, is coming from the idea that the human situation ought to be escapable somehow. And actually, when you give up and admit defeat in that particular quest, it's not really defeat. It's actually really empowering, because that's when you get to kind of, you know, really pour your time and energy into living life, instead of what is ultimately trying to sort of get out of the situation that we're all in.
Yeah. You're clearly a productive man. And I like the idea that a lot of good advice comes from people who have solved their own issues, their own problems, and then they share what they've learned widely with other people, with the public. And probably the best way to ask this to you is, how have you tried to solve that problem, that anxiety you were talking about earlier, to be productive, the feedback loop of getting positive reinforcement for being so productive? You talk a lot about how, and everybody has this problem, as you get the reputation as someone, for example, who is great at responding to email, what you find is an endless pit of responses to respond to people. And so for yourself, what, as you think about the arc of your life, what are the adjustments, the habit changes, that the philosophy changes that you've had that you feel like have really helped you?
Yeah, I want to say I don't think right now I have a reputation as someone who's very good at responding to email, but I maybe have. And the point, of course, is that the better you get, the more email you receive. I'm very happy to talk about some specific kind of techniques and methods that I've found useful. But I think the sort of overarching point I feel like I want to make is, I describe myself in the book in sort of former days as a productivity geek, you know, absolutely classically obsessed with every new system and method, and thinking that the next one was going to be the silver bullet that kind of finally got me in control and able to do everything and all the rest of it. It's not that that's gone away completely. It's not that I sort of am not kind of like, yeah, my antenna quiver when I hear about some new productivity system or an app that's supposed to solve everything. But it's more subtly like I've kind of seen through it in some way. There's been a sort of gradual but consistent and many years long lessening of the idea that there's ever going to be a solution to of the kind that my sort of the anxious part of my character seems to want. And the more you sort of see through that, it's a kind of a positive, I've described it in the past as disillusionment, but that's got very negative connotations in our language, but it's like a really positive disillusionment. It's a sort of lowering of the, or lightening of the burden that one is carrying through life, trying to get to this point where you can do everything. And it when you're no longer dedicating so much time and energy to that quest, it's freed up to, you know, take real action on a bunch of things that matter. So I think that, you know, how that sort of manifests on a day-to-day basis for me with work, I am quite a bit better than I was at working sequentially on things. You know, there are lots of different ways to do this in terms of how you organize your system or whatever, but just the basic idea of saying for now, these are the two or three things I'm trying to achieve. And yes, there are another 50 that I feel I ought to be getting on with. And they're urgent and they're meaningful. And by making them wait, I'm not suggesting that they are irrelevant, but I've just, you know, the only way to do this is to be willing to sort of focus on a handful of those things and make all the other ones wait. So that's sort of, I think we all feel anxious about having too much to do, and a lot of sort of knee-jerk responses and some bad productivity advice tries to get the anxiety to go away by doing more and more and more and more in the same amount of time. I think what I've learned gradually is to just tolerate those anxious thoughts, which then subside, right? This idea that, yeah, I probably should be getting on with all sorts of other things for some value of should, fine. But I'm going to do these for now. That's been a big change with me, I think. And also, and this may come partly from, you know, one's professional situation and having more sort of, I guess, power or seniority or whatever the right word is, as you sort of go through life and do more things. So it's not necessarily something that's easy for a 20-year-old to do, but it's this idea of sort of like allowing other people, as I've put it in the part, like to allow other people to have their problems, right? Like if somebody is impatient and would like me to be getting back to them on something, it might be in my interests to do that. I try to be a nice person, so I would also like to help them with whatever they're trying to get done. But ultimately, like, that's their issue.
Yeah.
Ultimately, if somebody else's anxiety does not create an obligation on me. And that's been a very useful way to think about it as I've done more and sort of reached more people through what I do. If you go into that with the idea that everybody must be placated at all times, it'll drive you completely crazy.
Yeah. There's a quote and a concept that came to mind as I was getting more and more familiar with your work. And I'm sure you have heard this this line before, because to me it summarizes a big point in your book, which is, this is from Steve Jobs, quote, "People think focus means saying yes to the thing you've got to focus on, but that's not what it means at all. It means saying no to the 100 other good ideas that there are. You have to pick carefully." And the other concept that kept coming to mind for me was the 80-20 rule, the 80-20 principle. And there's a great book by Richard Koch that I read years ago called Living the 80-20 Way. And a lot of that book is about getting real with yourself about what your, you know, he calls them happiness islands, the few activities, the few people that are providing you the overwhelming majority of your contentment, wealth, happiness, joy in life, and being more intentional about spending more of your limited resources, your time on those activities and with those people. I just wanted to say those two ideas to you and get any, you know, thoughts, either agreement or disagreement or anything you might want to expound on related to them.
It's really interesting because I immediately, because it's just my contrarian mindset, want to sort of quibble with them both. But the quibbling is in the service of a sort of deeper agreement with both of them. So, you know, I've certainly written things that are sort of contrary and sort of critical of the approach that Steve Jobs took to the sort of idea of a meaningful life. I think something very high pressure about how he often spoke about that, which maybe wasn't high pressure for him, a sort of true remarkable genius, but is not necessarily the most useful thing to hear if you're not clear what you should be doing with your life, for example. But in the quote that you mentioned, he gets at this very important notion, one way I've heard it put, and Elizabeth Gilbert has a lovely line about this, I don't remember the exact words, but we think that time management and making choices is a matter of sort of working up the guts to say no to all the things we don't want to do.
Yeah.
And what she and also Steve Jobs make clear in that quote is that, like, no, it's a matter of seeing that there are lots and lots of things that we want to do and that would be completely legitimate uses for our time, and that we still have to choose only a small number of those. So I think that idea that there's a real role for learning to neglect things and to neglect the right things, not because there's one right answer, but just because you're never going to be able to get there by convincing yourself that all the things you're not doing don't really matter. Like, no, they do really matter as well, but you just have to make some choices. And in fact, you know, to get kind of existentialist and Jean-Paul Sartrean with you for a moment, it's the act of choosing them that gives them their meaning. So I think that's a very important point. And then with the Richard Bach in the 80-20, again, this notion that you do, to at least to some extent, have to go all in on a few things rather than spread yourself over all of them. I've never really understood whether there's any validity in the exact ratio there, you know, the 80-20 rule. It's just, to me, it expresses that notion that, like, yes, if you think about it, what gives you a sense of meaning in life comes from a certain number of things, and it comes from only trying to do a certain number of that certain number. So that general spirit of, like, concentrate, don't dissipate, I think is important there, because the whole world is going to push you in the direction of spreading yourself too thinly. Like, that dynamic is taken care of. Your job is to, like, you know, resist it at least a little bit, I would say.
I wonder if you have thought a decent amount about this, and I bet the answer is yes. You mentioned earlier about how, you know, I think you identified yourself as a younger man as particularly, you know, an overachieving, insecure person. And I see a lot of that in myself. And I wonder if, in making these choices, that particularly for people with that kind of psychology, that kind of self identity, people pleasers, that it's particularly difficult for people that have a reputation and have kind of an inner life desiring to be everything to everyone, that it's particularly difficult to adopt a more sane and ultimately better outlook on time management. I wanted to just give that to you and see if you agree.
I think it's true. I mean, I think it's like, it's there's a very prevalent, it's sort of like a meme apart from anything else, but there's a very prevalent sort of thing that apparently lots of people have, which is this notion that, like, they're incredibly worried about people yelling at them or being mad at them or something like that. I'm actually super interested in how, like, it seems to get written about and expressed primarily as if it's something that is overwhelmingly an issue for women and not for men. But I actually think it's probably going on more with men than we realize. It's just that the ways we express ourselves as, you know, male cliches of expression don't end up, one doesn't end up talking about it so much, perhaps. This notion that it would be absolutely terrible to kind of disappoint somebody who's expecting something of you, or let somebody down who had really high hopes for something that you could do for them, or that every sort of message arriving in your inbox, wherever, you know, creates some kind of obligation to try to sort of to be dealt with. And of course, in certain contexts, that's true, right? If you have a job and the job description, the job requirements include meeting certain requests from your boss and your boss emails you, then yeah, kind of like you do have there's a debt to pay because you're being paid a salary and your job is to answer the email, but not a sort of existential debt. It's the difference between saying, yeah, sure, I have certain obligations, as do I. I'm self-employed, but I absolutely, you know, sign contracts to write books and things, and then I have to do those things. But to sort of separate that off from this idea that your basic adequacy as a human being depends on doing any of those things. So one of the things I say sometimes when I find myself giving talks to audiences that I think probably have a lot of insecure overachievers in them is like, you do realize that like, you don't have to do any of this, right? I mean, maybe you have to feed yourself and clothe yourself. And maybe you have to like, if you've got kids, you need to like provide them with shelter and send them to school, right? But putting those things aside, you don't have to have or attempt to have a sort of accomplished, high achieving, interesting career, right? You can think of yourself as starting from the position of being an okay human being and then do some things on top of that because it's fun and interesting and you find them absorbing, rather than starting from the idea that unless you manage to find a way to do more and more stuff, you'll sort of be a failure as a person. You know, this is where it helps, and I'm not, but this is where it helps to be religious, because many religious traditions, people's belief systems provide them with a sort of backdrop that says like, okay, be nice to achieve these things, but actually I am loved or whatever, regardless. There are other religious traditions that make them incredibly guilty and feel bad and make them think they've got to work around the clock. It all depends on which branch you're raised in. But I think that's the bit that I think is hard for insecure overachievers. It's like, you've got to sort of practice gently, like dropping a ball and seeing that the world doesn't collapse, or saying polite no to somebody and seeing that half the time they're like, just great, thanks for being clear with me and letting me know. There might be a British side to this too, you know. I think we are worse at just coming out and telling people sorry, don't have time for that.
Yeah, I feel like it's a muscle that many people would probably do well to begin to work out a little bit more. And this actually segues very nicely into a phenomenon I've heard you talk about that I think is notable about modern times. And you spoke about, I think that I'm getting this name right, a book by Daniel Markovitz, which I had not heard of before. And he talks about the curious truth about modern times, that the reward nowadays for being a winner, for getting the best job, for going to the best university, is the pressure to work unendingly for your entire life. And that in history, this is sort of something that's hiding in plain sight. But for most of history, the point of getting to a position of privilege or winning in society was to avoid toil. One of my favorite essays I've read, and I had this author on, an essayist a month and a half ago, was an essay called Toward a Leisure Ethic. And he went through, his name's Stuart Whatley, he went through a lot of the history of work, of the concept of work. And I'd be happy to send you the essay as well, because I've sent it to about a half a dozen friends. But I wanted to give you a little bit of space to talk about that phenomenon as well, that I think you hit the nail on the head in a prior interview where I heard you say that, you know, historically the point of winning was to begin to be able to own your time and to not be able to have somebody else tell you what to do, to be striving and achieving endlessly. I wanted to get your thoughts on why that seems to be the case in modern times and just the peculiarity of that truth.
Yeah. I mean, the why question is always so fascinating. And honestly, in my writing, I slightly evade it. I think there are lots of different streams of cause, and I'm not going to be the person who says it's one of them and not the others. But yeah, so first of all, I think that's very clear that what happens if you achieve high status and responsibility and wealth, often in our society, would have completely astonished pre-modern people who had wealth or power, that the idea that you would get busier in many ways as you achieve those things instead of less busy and having more leisure time. I mean, I think something to do with the economic system that we live in and the technological advances that we've made have sort of taken the lid off the what we can do, right? There's always going to be more to do. There's always going to be more wealth to accumulate, that traditions that would have kept that in check have somewhat eroded. So in a sense, part of the game we're all playing is that our felt needs, the things we want to pay for in our lives, or the things we like to achieve, the ambitions we have, there's no place at which they just sort of stop. They can always, you can always do more. And that's one of the reasons for the argument that Markowitz makes in The Meritocracy Trap. But there's all sorts of other ones, I think, as well. And really, as I say, I don't particularly, I'm not a social theorist. I don't think I have the answer, but it is just a really interesting and clearly true phenomenon that in all sorts of crucial ways, life gets, you might even want to say harder. I mean, you want to be careful to suggest that people living in serious poverty don't have the hardest lives, but certainly if you go from sort of middle management to senior management in a corporation or something, you can absolutely find yourself with more to do in less time. And meanwhile, of course, your standard of living drifts upwards, but then it starts to feel just as essential, right? So you have a nicer house with a bigger mortgage or a bigger rent. Like, it's just, it feels just as obligatory to meet that new standard as it did before. And there's all the social comparison of it. There's the sort of media, the fact that we're living in a world where somebody in any city, any town, wherever in England or the US, can see how Hollywood celebrities live, or social media influencers live, or don't really live, but present themselves as living, right? There's all this kind of, there's just no, there are none of the bulwarks that used to exist that sort of, whether it's a social norm that says, in return for being the CEO, you need to guarantee jobs for life to your employees, or whether it's sort of the context, religious and other contexts, where people would mix regardless of the social class they belong to, so that they could sort of have a sense of their responsibilities to other people. All sorts of things have changed. And now we're just sort of in this open-ended race. And it doesn't even matter if you think it's ridiculous, right? You still sort of have to play if you live in that world, because the market is going to set the rent in the city where you live, and you're going to have a place to live.
Yeah. It reminds me, and I'll probably butcher this, but there's a great line I've always loved from Nassim Taleb, that true success is not standing on top of a hierarchy. It is moving outside of the hierarchy altogether. And right. I know the concept of time, and I've done probably a half a dozen shows on this podcast about, you know, our lives, our humans' previous lives as hunter-gatherers, and that 90% of our, you know, human history were spent in tribes in that context. And I'd love to give you, in however much time you would, to speak about our concept of time has changed, you know, from the context in which mostly lived to the medieval age to now. The way we think about time now, according to arguments I've heard you make, is significantly different from perhaps the more natural way that humans have always dealt with time.
Yeah, this was one of the most interesting parts of researching the book for me, really. I mean, it's very easy to see that we feel a lot busier than we once did. Whether we actually are is a different question. That we have all sorts of purported ways of saving time that we didn't used to have access to. But the really interesting thing for me was understanding that this is all premised on an even more basic modern assumption. And I mean modern as in from around industrialization forwards, right? Which is the very idea that time, and actually before that, but it was sort of set the path for industrialization, that the very idea that time is something separate from oneself, this notion that we almost all have but don't usually realize we have, that there's you, and then there's your time as a resource, and your job is to manage it well. You probably feel sort of hounded by it, or maybe sometimes you feel like you're dominating it. You're really winning. In all those cases, it's a relationship. There's you, and then there's your time. And there's a lot of fascinating work, part of it anthropological, that sort of goes into how it's pretty likely that for a sort of average medieval peasant, at least, that most basic separation would barely have existed, right? It would not have been the case that you sort of thought about schedules and calendars or clocks. Most of that period, that there were no public clocks and no, you know, very few sort of markers of time in that way. Instead, you would have just lived in this state that anthropologists call task orientation, right? Where the rhythms of your day are dictated by the natural world, by the sort of small-scale agriculture that you're engaged in, probably. And it's not just that you would have had a more sort of peaceful life or something. It's that there wouldn't have been this separation in your mind between, like, okay, time is this container. Have I got too many things I need to put into the container to make it work properly, or have I got enough space, or am I using it badly? Am I wasting the time? You would have just been in time in a way that didn't make that distinction possible. And I think it's the same feeling that we do have access to, you know, ourselves, even today, at certain times when the sense of time falls away, certain kinds of intense experience. On some level, just the very idea of, like, being in flow, right? The very idea of being creative flow is one that doesn't appear to belong in time. So we can get there, but I think it would have been much more ordinary for many more people, even as the things that were happening in their lives were sort of abjectly terrible compared to our lives, right? You know, just disease and toil and famine and plague and war, but not time problems anyway.
I've spent a little bit of time in cultures that are not as quite as time obsessed as we are in England and the United States. Mm-hmm. And it does appear to be true that people in other cultures are far more present and seemingly far happier in a social context than a lot of Westerners are. And I reconcile that paradox that while we, you know, in our respective countries are often known for getting things done and being productive, but there's a trade-off to that. How you have reconciled that in your own life of wanting probably to be a bit more present than most people who are just constantly checking the time all the time.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting and sort of troublesome fact. That, and, you know, it isn't just the impressions of people from America and Britain, you know, traveling in other countries. It really does seem to be true from various attempts at doing happiness research among different countries that there is this strange relationship whereby people in parts of the developing world who on some level ought to be miserable are not, and then lots and lots of people on the Upper East Side of Manhattan are kind of deeply depressed when they've got everything you could dream of. And I think one way of understanding this, I think there are multiple ways, but I think one way of understanding this is that a lot of our psychological suffering, a lot of our sense of anxiety and unease in life comes from having this sense that there's somewhere we're trying to get to where we will be able to do everything, or we will be in control. We'll have security in some way. It's different for different people, but we'll have conquered the challenges of being human. And I think that is something that's sort of that's a mistake you can only make if you have a certain degree of privilege, right? If you have, if you're sort of basic living is taken care of, and then if you've got if you're in an economy where other people seem to be achieving these kind of great feats, if you've got access to the technology that you'd expect that could get you there, all of that enables you to believe that, like, happiness and achievement and meaning is coming off in the future. If you're in a setting where you know, it's harder to maintain a belief in that kind of that sort of ultimate conquest of things and being having security and control and all the rest of it. There's actually a sense in which you're sort of required to find meaning and joy and all the rest of it, you know, in the midst of your actual life and probably with lots of other people who are in the same boat, which is going to help because so much of happiness and fulfillment is social in that respect. And so I think part of what Americans and Brits are seeing when they travel in those places are people who are more present to a certain degree. Obviously, this is a broad brush claim, but, you know, more present to a certain degree because the illusions that not being present depends on are less available to them, if that makes sense. So, you know, I think a vaguely similar thing happens through the life cycle, and it, sometimes it gets called a midlife crisis, right? There are points in your life where it gets progressively harder to believe that the moment of truth is coming later, right? Because just about believe that when you're 18 or 25. And then if you're sort of in your 40s like me, it's like, well, hang on. Are you sure about this? And then some people sort of maintain that illusion well into life at even older ages. You know, very practically, I do try to, you know, I have a sort of meditation practice. It's not terrifically disciplined. I do just try to remind myself all the time that that this is my life, and that if I want to do things that matter with my life, that has to be now. And you know, I want to resist the urge to say like, well, look, I really value spending time with my son, so let me just kind of barely see him for 3 weeks while I get all this work out of the way. And yeah, then I'll really be able to be a great parent, because the work is never out of the way. So you just have to sort of say, okay, time to stop the work now in order to spend a few hours doing something else that really matters to me.
I heard you mention a figure, a writer that I think until very recently, very few people I know knew his name, Jim Hollis, who right, has been on my show twice. He's one of my favorite thinkers, one of my favorite writers.
Oh, awesome.
And interestingly, yesterday he went on Andrew Huberman's show, which has millions and millions and millions of followers. It's one of the most popular
podcasts. Did he really? Wow.
Yes, he did. And so I've always had
an interesting time to go on Andrew Huberman's show as well. Great. I should be
absolutely.
I should be watching that. Yep.
He is somebody I've always thought deserved a much bigger audience and was kind of ripe for the times in a lot of what he speaks about and writes about. And I knew I wanted to bring him up with you because I heard you say, I think, in terms of one of the things that has stuck with you about Jim is a question he often asks when facing decisions, which is, does this decision diminish or enlarge in me, as a decent barometer, a decent heuristic for making decisions in your life about how you want to spend your time. I think a lot of people who listen to interviews like this are interested in trying to figure out how best to spend their non-renewable resource of their time. And they want to give the space that's merited to try to figure that out. And so I wanted to set the table just by bringing him up and maybe ask you about him, what he's meant to you, and if he's influenced you at all about, because he's all about the larger questions. He's a Jungian. He's a very deep thinker. How he's had an influence on you, if at all, for how you have decided to spend your time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A completely extraordinary man, incredibly generous with his time and his writing. Astoundingly productive. He's still writing books, and I don't know his exact age, but he's elderly at this point. And really was my introduction to Jungian thought. So thought derived from the work of Carl Jung, which, you know, there are all sorts of things you can say about it. But I suppose one of the things that I really think about there is the idea that our psychological symptoms, you know, things like feeling depressed, feeling anxious, are not just things to be got rid of as quickly as you possibly can, but are messengers, or that at least it's useful to think of them as messengers from the unconscious, that they have something to say about how one is living and how one could live differently. And which is not to say that they're not also involved in like a chemical imbalance or something, but that kind of talk really misleads us from thinking of them as sort of not a part of us. And I think it's really important that we do think of them as a part of us. The other thing that, yeah, as you mentioned, that James Hollis, especially his book, Finding Meaning in the Second Half of Life, which was the first one that I came across, this notion that, I don't think he uses this term, but the thing that's been called by other people, right, the feeling of good difficulty, right? The idea of growth and sort of endless growth until the end of life, as the thing that we are going for here, or what Jung calls individuation, specific understanding of growth, or there are lots of different ways you could think about it, as opposed to, I'm not trying to get to some point in the future where I'm really happy all the time, and you know, then it's just like set it and forget it. You know, it's like at that point I'll just be smooth sailing forever. But actually, that sort of constantly growing in ways that are often not that pleasant, but always enriching and generative and deepening. You know, that is somehow the goal of life in a way. And that it's a struggle that you have to take on for yourself. You can't, you know, a book by Hollis is not going to give you a list of like, these are the six things you ought to be spending your time on, because that, again, the Jungian idea is that is a blueprint that is deep in you as an individual. And so that idea, does this choice enlarge me or diminish me? I've been very happy to play a small role in popularizing it, because I think it really gets around that question of like, is this going to make me happy or not? And it, which is a very troublesome question, because we're very bad at predicting what makes us happy. And some things can make you sort of happy for an evening, but then you wish you hadn't done it. And other things can be for sure, you know, not happy making when you're doing them, but you're incredibly glad that you did them looking back. And it also enables you, I've found this very useful, to distinguish between the kind of difficulty in a relationship or a job that is telling you, get out of this situation, it's bad, and the kind of difficulty that is really a part of growing into that role. And anyone who's been in a long-term relationship knows that there are certain kinds of difficulty, even conflict, that are part of what you are learning to do, just as there are obviously, you know, toxic relationships that you should get the hell out of as fast as possible. So just to finish with one quick example, I've found that question of Hollis is incredibly useful, because there were two different points in my life over the last sort of decade and a half where the question of whether I should leave the United States and return to United Kingdom was raised for me. And it was very clear to me that the first time, to have left where I was in the US would have been to run away from all sorts of things that actually it was time for me to face. That would have diminished me. And thankfully I listened to that and stayed. A few years ago, we moved as a family from New York to the north of England. And I think that, I mean, I guess time will tell, but I think that was different then, right? That was like, oh, now at this point, the exact same action had a totally different meaning, and it was enlarging, and it was the next chapter rather than a sort of running away from something. And I think that's a really powerful kind of distinction.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm talking a lot.
No, I love that. And I you know, it's been said that, you know, a mark of a genius is one's ability to simplify very complex things into these simpler concepts. And Jim is an absolute quote machine. I have a website of my favorite quotes personally. And I told him this the first time I met him, that it was largely comprised of stuff I had read in his books. And there are so many, and I'm sure I'll butcher some of them, but the quote is, I think, Jim interpreting Jung. And he says, the human psyche wants two things, a greater expression of its own capabilities and self-healing. And I just love lines like that, that compress, not perfectly, but a lot of what people are really after in life. There's a line I quoted the last time I talked to him, which Jim quotes all the time. And this is from Jung, that the spirit of evil is the negation of the life force by fear. And only boldness can deliver us from fear. The line after line, this guy, I feel like, delivers just prescient, important ideas. And yeah, I know he has just historically talked about how Jung noted that, you mentioned this earlier, that there's, in the decline of religion in the West, it was Jung's belief that depth psychology was crucial to try to shepherd people away from religious tribalism into a more individuated, meaningful life. So I wanted to put that to you, and I guess maybe follow up. I know you mentioned that you have gotten into meditation to some degree, but if there are any other practices that, you know, for yourself personally, have helped clarify how you want to be making decisions. And you just gave the example of moving back to England. I personally journal a lot. I found that to be extremely useful. But anything you'd like to add to that, I'd love to hear.
Yeah. So just firstly, on the sort of, I mean, I think that on the quotations and on Hollis's amazing storehouse of them, it reminded me also of another one that I think I got from him, which is a paraphrasing, I think, of Rilke. Which is that the purpose of life is to be defeated by greater and greater things. Mm. I think that is a really spectacular way of getting at a lot of what we're talking about here. The things get greater and greater, but you are defeated by them.
Yeah.
So I was going to say journaling as well. I mean, I think that something that I've found especially useful recently in writing, both journaling and in sort of, you know, my writing for work, is sort of a certain kind of approach to what's called free writing that I used to disdain, right? I used to hate the idea that if I was writing something, I could just sort of sit down, keep my fingers moving, and like make a big mess on the page and then clear it up, because I was too uptight and perfectionistic about it. But I found that, you know, well, I think the original, you know, Julia Cameron morning pages advice is to write without stopping for whatever it was like three sides of a narrow ruled notebook. Not racing. The point is just to not stop. And this message was sort of underlined for me in a book I came across fairly recently, by an author called Stephen Lloyd Webber, which is called Deep Free Writing, which is a sort of a book for writers. He's a writing coach. But he's all about this idea that, you know, you set a timer, maybe, and you write either about a problem that you're facing, or you try to write something that you're trying to write, you know, if you're doing that for your work. And the rules are basically that you don't stop, and that you do your best to stay present. So you neither stop and think about it, nor do you sort of check out mentally. But that's it. You don't have to hurry. You don't try to, you know, put down the most words you possibly can. It's nothing like that. And I found that a really useful practice, because the temptation otherwise, of course, is to wait until you think you've got the right thing to set down, you know, and then you stop and you sort of fall into thought and 10 minutes pass and you haven't done anything. And I have found it, again, as saying both kinds of writing, journaling and in sort of writing, an incredibly useful thing. It's not the final draft of anything. It might not even be the first draft of anything, but it's that sort of getting out of one's own way, trusting that there is something inside you that has something wise to impart, and that your kind of uptight, anally retentive gatekeeper who sits in the way, kind of saying, no, that's not good enough, is basically a jerk. And it's good if you can find ways to, you know, sneak around him.
Hmm. I know we're getting close to the end of our time together. And before I close with a final question, I just wanted to, I know we've talked a lot about time, and I wanted to just say thank you again for giving me some of yours to have this conversation. I wanted to close by, you know, asking you a very open-ended question. You've done a lot of interviews like this about your book, which is extraordinarily successful. And I wonder if there are questions about the book that you have wanted to address, but haven't. There hasn't been a space to answer something about the book that you find important, or just the ideas in the book that you feel like are misinterpreted or not accurately conveyed. It's basically a big way for me to just leave you with the floor with the opportunity to talk about anything else that you think we haven't covered about your work, about these ideas that you think would be useful for people.
I mean, I think something that comes to my mind is how easy it is to take subject matter like the stuff I'm writing about, or even, you know, listen to a conversation like the one we've had and agree with it and find it useful, and then immediately set off to sort of perfectionistically try to implement it in your life in a way that ultimately kind of undermines the whole point, right? And I'm very prone to this, and certainly have been very prone to it. You read a book that might be very sort of generous and honest and about it, about how limited we all are and how there isn't a sort of way to get in control of everything and do everything perfectionistically. And I would hope that could be said about my writing. And then you set off to kind of become the perfect executor of that way of life. You sort of become perfectionistic about not being perfectionistic. There's a newsletter written by a woman called Catherine Andrews called The Sunday Soother, which and she once, it's very good, and she once titled one of her newsletters, "What if you're going about recovering from perfectionism all wrong?" Which I thought was like a really good satirical way of doing it, right? We can think of many sort of online media organizations that would use that headline, right? That would try to make you feel bad. She was joking, of course, but that you've sort of got to, you've got to find a way somehow, or so this attitude goes, to deal once and for all with your problem of being endlessly distractible, or your problem of trying to do too much, or your problem of being anxious about things. And so I think the real masterstroke here really is learning to be, and I still struggle with it, is learning to be forgiving of yourself about that as well, and understanding that there isn't going to be a sort of clear point of completion with any of these topics, and that even if you listen to us talking and you feel moved to sort of jettison some old way of doing things and do them differently, it's very easy for the old way to kind of co-opt the new way by telling you that actually you've got to do the new thing completely flawlessly and experience unbroken meaning and joy in life, otherwise you've screwed up, you know. So I think it's a endless sort of deepening spiral of self-forgiveness on some level, or it probably is for insecure overachievers anyway.
From one insecure overachiever to another, Oliver, thank you so much for the time. This is a real pleasure.
I've enjoyed it too. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Keep Talking. If you're finding value in this podcast, please consider supporting the show via the links below on Venmo, PayPal, or Patreon. Your support helps to make these conversations possible.